is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
As we know, it's already been beset by problems with locust infestation, and generally the models are suggesting below normal rainfall for quite a large portion of the Greater Horn of Africa.
That was Gavin Eiley, a humanitarian expert at the World Meteorological Organization, saying the Greater Horn of Africa is an area of particular concern as the La Nina weather phenomenon continues through January. Details coming up. Also, international observers arrived in Abidjan Wednesday to watch the electoral process that will choose the next leader of Ivory Coast. And the political opposition is rejecting results of Tanzania's election, saying the vote was illegitimate due to widespread fraud. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. International observers arrived in Abidjan Wednesday to watch the electoral process that will choose the next leader of Ivory Coast. The 47 observers are comprised of members from the Carter Center and the Electoral Institute for Democracy in Africa. To get a preview of Saturday's vote, International Edition Steve Miller spoke with Katarina Hoya in the Ivory Coast via WhatsApp. He began by asking her about expectations for the vote after leading opposition presidential candidate Pascal Affine-Nguessan and fellow opposition candidate Henry Konan Bedie call on their supporters to boycott the vote.
Well, like you said, the main opposition leader, Henry Konan Bedie, and Pascal Affine-Nguessan, who is running a small faction of the Ivorian Popular Front, former President Laurent Gbagbo's party, they have called for what they call a civil disobedience campaign, which includes their supporters boycotting the electoral process and also Saturday votes. However, their name still remains on the ballots. There's been very few people picking up their voter cards. Just about 40% of people have picked up the voting cards ahead of Saturday's vote. So we're likely to see a slightly lower participation. However, the Electoral Commission has extended the period when voting cards can be picked up, so people will be able to pick them up at the polling stations as well. But in reality, what we're seeing is this is an election between two candidates. It's President Alassane Ouattara and former lawmaker Kwadwo Konan Bertin, who participated in elections in 2015, but only managed to get 4% of the votes.
There has been some violence in the country leading up to the vote, and reports are that perhaps as many as 20 people have been killed in pre-election violence. What is the government doing as a preventative measure to prevent violence during the election?
At least 35,000 security forces will be deployed to secure the vote on Saturday. We're already seeing the presence of military police and military circulating here in Abidjan, the commercial capital. The situation has been tense since Ouattara announced he would run in early August. And indeed, at least 30 people have been killed in clashes between civilians and security forces, and also between supporters from the main political parties. They have also limited the number of the places of where the vote will take place. And even though we expect the vote to happen across the country, there might still be some areas where there could be clashes or threats that prevent people from voting.
Katarina, the election gets underway in earnest on Saturday, October 31st. What is the timeline for the official results to be announced by the Election Commission?
The counting will begin immediately when polling stations close here at 6 p.m. on Saturday. The Electoral Commission then has 5 days to announce the results that needs to be validated by the Constitutional Council. This year, there's also an electoral vote, an electronic vote counting that is likely to speed up the process a bit. So what we're hearing here is that they're hoping to have results within 2 days. But again, the Electoral Commission does indeed have 5 days to actually give them according to the law.
That's reporter Katarina Hoya speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller from Abidjan. The political opposition is rejecting results of Tanzania's election, saying the vote was illegitimate due to widespread fraud. Presidential challenger Tundu Lissu called on the international community not to accept figures emerging from Wednesday's voting. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
One day after Tanzanians cast votes in Wednesday's election, opposition figures in the East African country said they reject the whole election process. Opposition candidate Tundu Lissu told reporters Thursday in Dar es Salaam that results were full of irregularities and called on international bodies to take action.
We are asking our people to take this matter into their own hands through peaceful, mass, democratic action and protest. We are asking regional and international organizations that sent observers here, particularly the African Union. We ask those who sent observers to observe these elections not to confer any recognition to these illegitimate results.
The ruling party and government spokespeople have said they'll have no comment until all votes are counted. Tanzania's National Electoral Commission, NEC, chairman Semistokos Kaijage dismissed the reports of pre-ticked ballots as false and advised the citizens to ignore them.
Kuna taarifa zinazosambaa kwenye mitandao ya kijamii.
He says there have been some reports circulating on social media regarding the presence of pre-ticked ballot papers in Kawe, Pangani and Kigoma constituencies. Kajage adds that those reports of the allegations have not yet been submitted to the National Electoral Commission. He says we ask all citizens to ignore those reports because they are invalid and unproven. Early results show the majority of votes going to the ruling CCM party led by President John Magufuli. Absalom Kibanda is a political analyst.
Japo ni mapema sana kuzungumzia ushindi huo unapozingatia hasa kwamba tuna majimbo jumla majimbo.
Kibanda says that although it is very early to talk about a ruling party victory as there are 264 constituencies, it's a bad beginning and sign to opposition parties. If that continues, he says, we may find that we have very weak opposition parties in the coming parliament compared to the previous period of 5 or 10 years. The official final election results are expected Friday. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council, says having the country stricken from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism means a return to the international community with access to international aid and economic and technological opportunities. To allegations that the announced normalization with Israel is a betrayal of the Arab national cause and the Palestinians, al-Burhan said Sudan should not bear the whole responsibility for creation of a Palestinian state in the pre-1967 borders. Khidr Haroun, former Sudanese ambassador to the U.S., explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi the economic gains that Sudan could gain by getting its name removed from the terror list.
This is partially true. The delisting of Sudan from the list of the countries accused by the Americans of supporting international terrorism will pave the way for benefiting for the first time from the debt relief. The IMF and World Bank have a special designation known as Initiative for Heavy Indebted Poor Countries, HIBIC, that have high level of heavy debt, making them eligible to receive special assistance. Sudan is among those countries, but due to being in that list, the United States has been using its veto for any attempt to make Sudan benefit from that relief. Secondly, Sudan has been for decades conducting business outside of the international banking system. Around 3 million Sudanese in diaspora still cannot transfer money to their relatives in Sudan through banks and vice versa. I mean, students cannot receive support from their families through the international banking system. Sudan can now be eligible to take development loans from the World Bank and IMF and could join WTO. All of that was hinging on this delisting. Sudan now can buy spare parts for his crippled airlines and locomotives. I said partially in the beginning because the consequential factor is whether the government will prepare the right and effective policy to make those benefits materialize. Because, you know, there are conditions to benefit from the HIBIC initiative, which include also very austerity policies, such as curbing the government expenses and also removing subsidies from a lot of major commodities in the country. So it is still conditioned to the what the government economic policies would be.
To charge that the announced normalization with Israel is a betrayal of the Arab national cause and the Palestinians, Al-Burhan said that we all want a Palestinian state in the pre-1967 borders, but we do not want Sudan to bear the whole responsibility for that. What's your take on that?
Commenting on what Burhan had said, no one has asked Sudan to carry the burden alone of the Palestinian people. I believe what is needed is that Sudan and international community should have been steadfast in their adherence to the United Nations Security Council resolutions 224 and 338 and the Oslo Agreement along with the Arab Initiative of 2002 as the best solution to the Palestinian questions. Land for peace resulted in two states living side by side in peace. It is a matter of principle. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. of the civil rights movement in the United States opposed Vietnam War in spite of President Lyndon Johnson's positive role in adopting the Civil Rights Act. He said, justice is indivisible and it should be prevailed everywhere.
Not all are convinced that Sudan has much to gain from normalizing with Israel. Ash-Shafi Khidr, an economics professor and former leader of the Sudanese Communist Party who opposes the agreement, said the only thing to be gained from peace with Israel is the removal of Sudan's name from the terrorist list. How popular within the Sudanese community is normalization with Israel?
I think people above 40 years old are ambivalent about normalization with Israel, some for religious beliefs, some for pan-Arabism convictions, and large number for perceiving the issue as a humanitarian one, a case of oppressed people under occupation. I do not think that there would be significant economic gains for Sudan as a result of normalization. This is an exaggeration of the situation. But even though we have some gains, making gains at the expense of other people is immoral and inhumane. We should remember that Jesus Christ said once, not live by bread alone, man.
That's Kadir Haroon, former Sudanese ambassador to the U.S., speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The World Meteorological Organization predicts La Nina will continue through January and is expected to usher in drier and wetter conditions than normal in different parts of the world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The latest seasonal forecasts indicate the La Nina event will cause drier than normal conditions in much of East Africa and lead to increased rainfall in southern Africa. Central Asia is likely to see below normal rainfall earlier than usual. The World Meteorological Organization reports some of the Pacific Islands in the northern region of South America will see some of the most significant precipitation anomalies associated with this year's La Nina event. A cooling of ocean surface water along the Pacific coast of the South American tropics that occurs on average every 2 to 7 years. Some countries and regions are particularly vulnerable to changes in weather patterns. WMO humanitarian expert Gavin Eiley tells VOA the Greater Horn of Africa is an area of particular concern.
As we know, it's already been beset by problems with locust infestation, and generally the models are suggesting below normal rainfall for quite a large portion of the Greater Horn of Africa. So obviously that could have a number of impacts, but in areas like Somalia, so we always need to keep an eye on the sort of latest outlook.
WMO says governments can use weather forecasts to plan ways to reduce adverse impacts in climate-sensitive sectors like agriculture, health, water resources, and disaster management. WMO Deputy Director of Climate Services Max Dilley says governments can use La Niña forecasting to adapt their strategies to the changing weather patterns.
You can imagine in the agricultural sector that some crops will do well under wet conditions and others will do better under dry conditions. And there are agricultural management practices that can be adjusted to take account of whether it's expected to be wet or dry.
Dilley says WMO increasingly is trying to tailor these forecasts to specific concerns, such as food security or human health. For example, he says wet conditions alone do not provoke outbreaks of dengue fever or malaria. He says temperature, humidity, and also vegetation create the conditions for mosquitoes to breed. So rather than just giving a rainfall forecast, he says meteorologists will provide a forecast that is correlated with these diseases and can be used for dengue fever or malaria control. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In South Africa, as in other parts of the world, many healthcare workers are enduring physical and mental anguish to go along with the medical risk of treating COVID-19. Most hospitals in the country have programs focused on the short-term physical health of their doctors and nurses. But research suggests many in healthcare, especially doctors, will suffer long-term moral injury, as it's known in the field, due to their work during the pandemic. Darren Taylor reports.
Moral injury happens when doctors have to make life and death decisions, such as which COVID-19 patients get limited numbers of ventilators. It's also caused by high mortality rates and not being able to help patients because there's no effective medicine available. Working at a hospital that's come under severe pressure from coronavirus patients, Dr. Chapile Tlali knows all about moral injury. He says his first experience with it came when the Department of Health instructed hospitals to be more selective about who they tested for COVID-19 because South Africa was running out of test kits.
That created quite a challenge because as the numbers started to rise up, we had a lot of people who came to the clinic that we couldn't test based on their risk factors. And that, for me, left me very worried about the fact that they would go back to their communities as someone who was COVID positive and the fact that the diagnosis...
Clarley says those infected but untested people therefore wouldn't be on a list that would enable their contacts to be traced.
That would mean that their contacts might get the virus and their contacts might get the virus, etc. That would start a whole new outbreak in a certain area. I felt a little bit responsible if that would happen.
As infections rose, so too did backlogs of patients waiting to be tested and treated. Clarley also became distressed by the way patients were being handled. There were so many who needed help, he says, that there was space for them only outside the hospital, in the open air.
They would wait there with oxygen cylinders that you weren't sure when they would finish. And I felt that for very, very sick people who are sitting outside in the middle of winter, that stripped them of their dignity.
The doctor says his facility was soon overwhelmed by COVID-19 patients.
Seeing these patients with about half the staff complement, the other half was either in quarantine or in isolation with the virus, it became very, very strenuous. You know, I started getting burnt out. I became irritable. And I started developing a sense of apathy in my work and in my life.
Clarley says the pressures caused by the pandemic turned him into a person he thought he'd never be.
Certain things, you know, that keep you going as a doctor is maintaining a certain level of respect and care for your patients. And I found myself not caring.
His relatives, friends, and colleagues began pleading with him to take time off.
They could see that I was run down and I didn't want to take a break because that was the moment where I was needed the most. But fortunately or unfortunately, I contracted the virus. Although it wasn't an easy time, I think it was a blessing in disguise because that gave me that time to rest and recuperate. And
mental health care experts advise that doctors work in teams to treat patients during the pandemic. This will allow them to support one another and make potentially distressing decisions together. They say it's also essential that doctors and nurses be given time and space to rest, even if they feel they don't need to. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The war of words between France and Turkey over cartoons portraying Islam's prophet Muhammad, triggered by the recent beheading of a French teacher, continues to escalate. But behind the diplomatic storm over freedom of expression versus religious sensitivity is a bitter rivalry for influence in Africa. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
To rousing applause from parliamentary deputies of his party, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Wednesday accused Western countries of seeking to relaunch the Crusades. Erdogan's latest salvo is over French President Emmanuel Macron's defence of the publication of cartoons of Islam's prophet Muhammad.
Mekke'ye, Medine'ye, Asya'ya, Afrika'ya, Avrupa'ya,
Erdogan said it's an issue of honour for Turkey to stand against the attacks against the Prophet, who honoured Mecca, Medina, Africa, Asia, Europe, in the whole world and at all times. The Turkish president has sought to present himself as a global defender of Muslim rights. But the current dispute over the cartoons is part of a growing rivalry between France and Turkey, says analyst Sinan Ülgen of the İDAM Research Institution in Istanbul.
There's a different positioning regionally, with France having established a strategic alliance with the United Arab Emirates, ostensibly to fight against the influence of political Islam in the Middle East and Northern Africa, and where Turkey is seen, on the contrary, as belonging to the other camp, namely of, you know, supporting political Islam through its relationships with the different entities and the Muslim Brotherhood.
France and Turkey back rival sides in the Libyan civil war, while Erdogan is a strong critic of the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, a key French ally. Turkey is now challenging France's powerful influence in the predominantly Muslim West African countries that were once French colonies, says Emre Çalışkan of Britain's University of Oxford.
Turkey is a newcomer, emerging power. Their interest and their presence are threatening French interest and vice versa. Turkey is trying to secure the region around the countries in Libya. So we saw Erdogan's visit to Niger and Turkey recently engaging with Mali.
Earlier this year, Turkey signed a defense agreement with Niger. The Turkish military already has a presence in Libya. For now, analysts say Ankara's priority is to build a strategic presence in the region. But Turkish companies are also eyeing African markets, currently dominated by French firms, which analysts say can only add to the deepening rivalry between Turkey and France. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.